happy to share that Ken Oates has agreed to start uploading all the Dharma talks, and Talis trained him the other day, so those will be available, thanks to Ken. And everything else is available, thanks to everybody else, so thanks for being everybody else. So one of the cool things about the form that we do, the way we move around, is that there's pretty much signals for everything, right, that we respond to. And so in the prostrations, for instance, there's a second bell at the end of the last one. So you should have joined me. We hadn't heard the second bell. So we just keep bowing all night until the dawn has the second bell. Yeah. You know, in other words, it's actually kind of, and I'm kind of joking a little bit, but it's kind of very serious too. Like there's one of the texts that we chant that says something like, don't make up standards of your own, right? So if the bell hasn't rung to say stop bowing, just keep bowing. Teachers of old would yell at you for stuff like that. We don't do that. Oh, a couple more form things while I'm telling you what to do. one is that for the Tenkans, the big candle is an offering of light to the Buddha. So you wouldn't really stick a match in a light offering. So you can just use the little matchbox to light the, you know, when you're lighting the other stuff. Who knows we're doing that. And also the mudra, you know, is kind of an important part of the Zazen form. So it's the left, you know, the right hand on the bottom, left hand on the top, the knuckles are kind of lined up, thumb tips just barely touching. And there's kind of an aliveness to it. It's like you're holding a little ball of energy or something. So it's not just like some place to put your hands, but it's like this kind of special thing. And it's okay to not always make the mudra. It's not that, you know, a kind of thing, but I think it would be a shame to sit Zazen and like never make the mudra, you know, because it's part of the Zazen form, you know. So you wouldn't quite exactly be doing Zazen. You'd be doing meditation, which is nice, but Zazen's a particular way of sitting. So. When you're standing, no, it's the same.
Oh, it's always the right hand on the bottom.
Right hand's on the bottom, yeah. Okay. Or on the outside. Yeah. So yeah, standing, it's right about the belly button there, solar plexus. Forearms are more or less parallel. And yeah, so it's like it has this nice thing. Thanks for asking. Anyway, back to what I'm supposed to be doing. So tonight we reached double digits in the Mumon Khan project, the 48 stories in the Gateless Gate, or the Barrier That Has No Gate collection. We're on case 10. Here's the story. A monk named Xing Zhui said to Zaoshan, Xing Zhui is alone and poor. Please help out. Zaoshan said, Reverend Xing Zhui. It's hard to say these words. Xing Zhui. Reverend Xing Zhui. Xing Zhui said, yes. And Zaoshan said, you have already drunk 3 cups of wine, the finest wine in China, and yet you still say that you have not moistened your lips. So in this story, Xing Zhui is the student, and Zaoshan is the teacher, and they actually are long-term student and teacher. So presumably the monk has been in this monastery for a long time, they know each other very well. Sometimes it's like a visiting monk, so it's helpful to kind of get that part of the story back, the backstory. So a monk, a student named Xing Zhui, said to the teacher, Zaoshan, Xing Zhui, meaning I, is alone and poor. Please help out. The teacher, Zaoshan, said, Reverend Xing Zhui, the student said, yes. And the teacher said, you have already drunk 3 cups of wine, the finest wine in China, and yet you still say that you have only moistened your lips. So, not really much is known about the student, Xing Zhui, but the teacher, Zaoshan, was an important teacher in the 9th century in China. I don't really know much about him personally, but it's said in the book that he was important in sort of standardizing the way the koans were presented. And in fact, he's credited as one of the two founding teachers of Soto Zen, of our school. And Soto, here's the language layers. Soto is the Japanese voicing of Sao Dong. And the first character of this teacher is Sao. So he's the Sao in Sao Dong. The second character, Dong, is for Dungshan, who I've heard a lot more about Dungshan. So anyway, an important teacher and his long-term student having an exchange. So here we have a monk proclaiming something and asking for help. And he refers to himself by name, which is interesting. And not uncommon, a way of sort of getting a little out of this sort of sticky trap of me, you know. You could refer to yourself as the third person. Just sound funny, but it actually might help you calm down a little bit, you know. Right? Such a different thing to say, I'm so upset, versus, oh, Tim is upset today, you know. And you're like, oh, poor Tim, you know. He'll feel better soon, right? As opposed to, I'm upset, it's like, okay, universe, you need to give me all the stuff I want, and, you know, fix me and everything. So he refers to himself in the third person and says, I'm alone and poor, please help. So the please help is interesting. It's hard to tell in these stories if that's an actual straight-up request for some assistance, some guidance, or a kind of playful jab at the teacher, more along the lines of, I've got it, don't I? You know, I mean, it's more like that. And it's hard to actually tell what he means by alone and poor. What is he saying? I'm alone and poor. Is that a problem? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Doesn't sound so nice to us, although we all value our solo time, I think. When we feel alone, it's maybe not such a great thing. And although I think because of our sort of collective zeitgeist that we all may claim to be not so seduced by the material world, we would all of us very much not like to be poor. So it sounds like a bad thing. I'm lonely and broke. Please help out. There's a gentleman sitting on the steps that come out of our emergency entrance, kind of just outside the garden wall this afternoon, who, if I've seen there two or three times before, I assume he's experiencing homelessness. And I said, good to see you again. And he said the same thing he said last time I saw him, which was, is it okay that I'm here? And I said, so fine, the least we can do. How's your day going? And he said, could be worse. And he said, and I'm sorry to be so negative. And I was like, oh, gosh. I don't know what's going on for you, but you can be however you are. So it seems like alone and poor is probably not a good thing, and he's asking for help. How can I not be so alone and poor? Poor are probably not materially poor. These are monastics. But maybe poor in spirit, or poor in energy, or poor in understanding. But one commentary I read, the translator Thomas Cleary, who's not so much a Dharma teacher, but a great translator, knows a lot about the Chinese culture of the era in which this was written, says, actually, no, it's code for a really good thing. To be alone is to be independent, to be settled, to be sure of yourself, to be comfortable in your own skin. So a little more like, pay attention to me or don't pay attention to me, I'm fine, you know, everything's fine. And Cleary says that poor means free. Free from attachments, free from limited ways, total acceptance, no grasping. That poor here actually means like nirvana. Everything is come to rest. And there's a rich literary tradition in Japan, and probably in China too, around the peacefulness of being alone and possessionless. That actually, that's a great kind of freedom. And this goes back, it's a reference to the original monastics who the literature of Buddhism says were possessionless monks living by rule. You would have three robes, one bowl, one pair of sandals, and a little medicine if you needed medicine. That's all you would own. Although it seems to be true of our practice and all world religions that the way they say it was and the way it was isn't always quite the same. So I have a Buddhist studies book on my shelf that I've really just skimmed, the title of which is Buddhist Monks and Business Matters. And it's about all the possessions and actual businesses that the monks retain an interest in. A little bit like our dear president, you know. So there is evidence that the possessionless monks sometimes maintained a few things for later, you know, in case monasticism didn't work out or something. Or, you know, out of very altruistic reasons to take care of their families or, you know, maintain the social fabric of their village or their town. Because in the early Buddhists, when the whole bunch of men from Buddha's village in the Sakya kingdom all became monks all at once, it actually was a big problem, you know what I mean? It's like all the eligible men going off to war, all the eligible men went off to like sit on their butts and do nothing, you know? And so it was a big problem for the woman. So it was part of the origin of the Buddhist woman's order that they were basically like, screw it, we're not gonna just hang around and do all the work, you know? And they went to the Buddha and said, well, we wanna be ordained too if the men are just gonna leave, you know? And the Buddha agreed, you know, reluctantly, but he agreed. So anyway, there's a long tradition of the nobility of being a possessionless monastic. And it makes me think of the famous Japanese monk poet Ryokan. Do you know Ryokan? Mm-hmm. Here's a few poems by Ryokan. So maybe this monk is referencing something like this, you know, to be alone and poor is a beautiful thing. Ryokan wrote, in my little begging bowl, violets and dandelions mixed together, an offering for the Buddhas of the three worlds. In my little begging bowl, violets and dandelions mixed together as an offering to the Buddhas of the three worlds. Of course, violets and dandelions are very ordinary flowers, right? And the few possessions that one had as a noble person of poverty were like real treasures to you too, you know? Another ryokan. This one has a title. My cracked wooden bowl. This treasure was discovered in a bamboo thicket. I washed the bowl in a spring and mended it. After morning meditation, I take my gruel in it. At night, it serves me soup or rice, cracked, worn, weather-beaten, misshapen, but of noble stock. Nice, huh? He's not going to take that to Goodwill, you know? But several times in Ryokan's life, his stuff was stolen, even though he didn't have much. So here's one of the various poems he wrote. He wrote these great post-theft poems, you know, that was one of his inspirational moments. So here's one of his post-theft poems, and maybe he lost his cracked wooden bowl, too. And he wrote, left behind by the thief, the moon in the window. Left behind by the thief, the moon in the window. Another one. I couldn't find it, but another one says something like, if only the thief had stayed, I would have offered him the moon. So he had this moon theme. Getting close to a full moon now, I understand. My friend, who's a perfectly competent psychologist, was telling me he thinks everyone's really having a hard time because of the full moon coming up. So who knows? You know, maybe that's true. I was feeling low energy, and he said, well, I know why. Why? It's the moon. Yeah, you too? Yeah, it's the moon. Well, last one from Ryokan. And this one's about the richness, you know, the wealth. The wealth of aloneness, the wealth of poverty. There's quite a few like that. What is this life of mine? Rambling on, I entrust myself to fate. Sometimes laughter, sometimes tears, neither layman nor monk, as an early spring rain drizzles on and on. But the plum blossoms have yet to brighten things up. So all morning I sit by the hearth, no one to talk to. I search for my copybook and then brush a few poems. Mm-hmm. And this great sense of like, you know, plenty of time, you know. Just going to sit there and do a poetry until the plums blossom, you know. Didn't own a calendar or an iPhone. So maybe that's what the monk in our story, Xing Zui, is expressing. I think I said it right that time, Xing Zui. Expressing his contentment in the practice. Great news, teacher, I'm alone and poor. What help do I need? You know, and that's what he meant. But all the other teachers I read suggest it's a little more like our first reading. The monk is feeling lonely and desperate and doubting himself, you know. Doubt is a big thing that comes up in monastic practice. Pretty much you feel in doubt and you believe that nobody else feels in doubt. That's pretty much how it is. So it kind of works either way. And then the teacher calls out to him. Calls him by name. Tim? Edie? Carrie? And this is a great kind of training to have somebody who's willing to call to you, to notice you, and call your name with energy and with an expectation that there's no reason why you can't wake up right now. You know, it's kind of like, Kate, what are you doing? You know? And Kate can answer, yes, I'm here. Yeah. This is kind of like bone on bone, you know, this is very deep connection. It's not just like, hey you, you know, yeah, you know. Yes, I'm really here. Really here. Yes, I trust the Dharma. I trust my practice. I trust you, teacher, even when I'm feeling alone and poor. Especially then. I may be doubtful, but I'm not disillusioned. You know, I'm down, but not out. Because actually, our practice, which, you know, with our, you know, neuroplastic postmodern bias, we think is fixing us up. Did you appreciate my question earlier? Mm-hmm. Even though we think it's fixing us up, it's actually all about trusting that we're already all right. And so then the final line of the poem is interesting. After the monk presents, either I'm fine or I'm not, please help me. You know, and the exchange of his name and yes. Then the teacher says, you have already drunk 3 cups of the finest wine in China, and still you say you have not moistened your lips. You say you're alone and poor. You don't realize there's a jewel sewn into your robe. You don't realize that the treasure is right beneath your feet, right in front of your eyes, which is a common trope in religious literature. You know, all traditions have stories about the people who think that they don't have what they need, and they have to go on a little journey, you know, to find what they had all along. So maybe that's what we're doing. So a great example from Buddhism is the parable of the rich man and his son. This is chapter 4 of the Lotus Sutra. And a little backstory, and then I'm going to share this story with you, and that'll be kind of a way of time, I think, for. Interestingly, the story is not told by the Buddha. The story is told by the students. Maybe they all said it as one. It doesn't say which student says it. It describes in there that 5 or 6 of the primary early students of the Buddha, you know, Kashyapa and Moggallana and Ananda and all those guys, were saying to the Buddha in the Lotus Sutra, in which the Buddha reveals new teachings. They're saying that, gosh, you know, we thought we had something of value, but now we see that we were really like somebody who just didn't get it, thought they were desperately poor, and didn't realize that the true treasures were right at hand. And that, O Buddha, makes us think of this story. So can we tell you this story? So they actually tell a story to the Buddha to demonstrate that they get this new level of understanding, this deeper way of being. Not merely nirvana, but Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, which is great perfect enlightenment that's in the Heart Sutra that we just chanted. So the Lotus Sutra is a wonderful story full of fantastic, a wonderful sutra full of fantastic stories, but it also has a bit of a dig on the early Buddhists built into it. So this story actually is kind of that too, that the early Buddhists are the desperate poor man in the story, and eventually they wake up thanks to the Buddha's kindness to the true teachings. So anyway, here's what they told the Buddha. I'll try not to comment, but just read the story. Suppose there was a man, still young in years, who abandoned his father and ran away, and lived for a long time in another land, perhaps 10, 20, or 50 years. As he grew older, he found himself increasingly poor and in want. He hurried about in every direction, seeking clothing and food, wandering farther and farther afield, until by total chance he returned in the direction of his homeland. The father, meanwhile, all these years, had been searching for his son without success. And having taken up residence in a certain city, the father's household was very wealthy, with immeasurable riches and treasures. Gold, silver, lapis lazuli, coral, amber, and crystal beads filled and overflowed from his storehouses. He had many grooms and manservants and clerks and attendants and elephants and horses, carriages, oxen, and goats beyond number. The father engaged in profitable ventures at home and in all lands around and had dealings with many merchants and traveling vendors. But all this time he was the impoverished son was wandering from village to village, passing through various lands and towns, until at last he came to the city where his father was residing. The father had been thinking constantly of his son, but though he had been parted from him for over 50 years, he, the father, had never told anyone about the matter. You know, he was originally from a different city, so he never told anybody he had this estranged son. He merely pondered to himself, with his heart filled with regret and longing. He thought to himself that he was getting old and decrepit, and that he had great wealth and possessions, gold, silver, and rare treasures that filled and overflowed from his storehouses, but he had no son, so that if one day he should die, the wealth and possessions would be scattered and lost, for there was no one to entrust them to. This was the reason he constantly thought so earnestly of his son. And he also had this thought: if I could find my son and entrust my wealth and possessions to him, then I would feel contented and easy in mind, and I would have no worries. World-honored one, at that time, the impoverished son drifted from one kind of employment to another until he came by chance to his father's house. And he, the son, stood by the side of the gate, gazing far off at his father, who was seated on a lion throne, his legs supported by a jeweled footrest, while Brahmins, noblemen, and householders uniformly deferential surrounded him. Festoons of pearls worth tens or tens of thousands adorned his body, and clerks, grooms, and manservants holding white fly whisks stood in attendance to left and to right. A jeweled canopy covered him with flowered banners hanging from it. Perfumed water had been sprinkled all over the ground. Heaps of rare flowers were scattered about, and precious objects were ranged here and there, brought out and put away and handed over and received. It's just this wealth party, you know? Great. Such were the many types of adornments and emblems of prerogative and marks of distinction. When the impoverished son saw how great his father's power and authority were, he was filled with fear and awe and regretted that he'd ever come to such a place. Secretly he thought to himself, "This must be some king, or one who is equal to a king. This is not the sort of place where I can hire out my labor and gain a living. I should better go to a poor village, where if I work hard, I will find a place and earn food and clothing. If I stay here for long, I may be seized and pressed into service in this fine household." Having this thought, he raced from the spot. So it doesn't say it, but in other words, he didn't recognize his own father. He'd been gone for 50 years. Didn't recognize his father. The context is a little different, you know. So at that time, the rich old man, seated on his lion throne, spied his son and recognized him immediately. His heart was filled with great joy, and at once he thought, "Now I have someone to entrust my storehouses of wealth and possessions to. My thoughts have constantly been with this son of mine, but I had no way of seeing him. Now suddenly he's appeared before me, of himself, which is exactly what I would have wished, for I am old and decrepit. I still care for what becomes of my belongings." He's trying, you know. Therefore, the father dispatched a bystander to go after his son as quickly as possible and bring him back. So at that time, the messenger raced swiftly after his son and laid hold of him. You know, the impoverished son, alarmed and fearful, cried out in an angry voice, "I have done nothing wrong. Why am I being seized?" But the messenger held on tightly and forcibly dragged him back. At that time, the son thought to himself, I've committed no crime, yet I've been taken prisoner. Surely I'm going to be put to death. He was terrified and sank to the ground, fainting with despair. The father, observing from a distance, spoke to his messenger, saying, I have no need of this man. Don't force him to come here. Sprinkle cold water on his face so he'll regain his senses. I guess he really did faint. And then say nothing more to it. Why did he do that? Because the father knew that his son was of humble outlook and ambition, and that his own rich and eminent position would be difficult for his son to accept. He knew very well that this was his son, but as a form of expedient means, he refrained from saying to anyone, including his son, this is my son. The messenger said to the son, I am releasing you now, you may go where you wish. The impoverished son was delighted, having gained what he had not had before, and picked himself up from the ground and went off to find a poor village in order to look for food and clothing. At that time, the rich man, hoping to entice his son back again, decided to employ an expedient means and send two men as secret messengers, men who were lean and haggard and had no imposing appearance. Go seek out that poor man and approach him casually. Tell him you know of a place where he could earn twice the regular wage if he agrees to the arrangement. Then bring him back here and put him to work. If he asks what sort of work he'll be put to, say that he'll be employed to clear away excrement, and that you two will be working with him. The two messengers set out at once to find the poor man, and when they had done so, spoke to him as they had been instructed. At that time, the impoverished son asked for an advance on his wages and went with the men to clear away excrement. When the father saw his son, he pitied and wondered at him. Another day, when he was gazing out the window, he saw his son in the distance, his body thin and haggard, filthy with excrement, dirt, sweat, and defilement. So the father took off his necklaces, his soft, fine garments, and his other adornments, and put on clothes that were ragged and soiled. He smeared dirt on his body, took in his right hand the utensil for removing excrement, and assuming a gruff manner, spoke to the laborers, saying, keep at your work. Don't be lazy. By employing this expedient means, he was able to approach his son at last. Later, he spoke to his son again, saying, now then, young man, you must keep on to this work and not leave me anymore. I will increase your wages. And whatever you need in the way of utensils, rice, flour, salt, vinegar, and the like, you must not worry about. I have an old servant I can lend you. When you need him, set your mind at ease. I will be like a father to you. Because I am well along in years and you are young and sturdy. When you're at work, you should never be deceitful or lazy or speak angry or resentful words. You don't need to have any faults of that kind in the way those other workers do. From now on, you will be like my own son. And the rich man proceeded to select a name and assign it to the man as if he were a child. At that time, the impoverished son, though he was delighted at such treatment, still thought of himself as a person of humble station, who was in the employ of another. Therefore, the rich man kept him clearing away excrement for the next 20 years. By this time, the son felt like he was understood and trusted. Really good at clearing away the shit, you know? And he felt like he could come and go at ease. And he continued to live in the same place as before. Well, world-honored one, at that time, the rich man fell ill and knew he would die before long. So he spoke to the impoverished son, saying, I now have great quantities of gold, silver, and rare treasures that fill and overflow from my storehouses. You will now take charge of the amounts I have and of what is to be handed out and gathered in. So you will manage this now. That is what I have in mind, and I want you to carry out my wishes. Why? Because from now on, you and I will not behave as two different persons. You must keep your wits about you and make sure there are no mistakes or losses from the storehouses. The impoverished son, having received these instructions, took over surveillance of all the goods and gold and silver and rare treasures and of the various storehouses, but never thought of or appropriated for himself as much as the cost of a single meal. He continued to live where he had before, unable to cease thinking of himself as mean and lowly. After some more time has passed, the father perceived that his son was bit by bit becoming more self-assured and magnanimous in his outlook, and that he was determined to accomplish great things and despised his former low opinion of himself. Realizing that his own end was approaching, he ordered his son to arrange a meeting with his relatives and the king of the country, the high ministers and the noblemen and the householders. They all gathered together. When they're all gathered together, he proceeded to make this announcement. Gentlemen, you should know that this is my son, who was born to me in such and such a city. He abandoned me and ran away, and for over 50 years he wandered and suffered hardship. His original name was such and such and such, and my name is such and such. In the past, when I was living in my native city, I worried about him and set out to find him. Sometime after, I suddenly chanced to meet up with him. This is the truth of my son, and I, in truth, am his father. Now everything that belongs to me, all my wealth and possessions, now belongs entirely to this son of mine. Matters of outlay and income that have occurred in the past, this son of mine is familiar with. When the impoverished son heard these words of his father, he was filled with great joy. He was ready, he was ready. Having gained what he never had before, what he always had, he thought to himself, I originally had no mind to covet or seek such things, yet now these stores of treasures have come to me of their own accord. World-honored one, this old man has, with his great wishes, is none other than the Tathagata. So it's all a metaphor. So that's the Buddha. The father was actually the Buddha. And we are all like the Buddha's sons. The Tathagata constantly tells us that we are his sons, but because of the three sufferings, world-honored ones, in the midst of birth and death, we undergo burning anxieties, delusions, and ignorance, and we delight in clinging to lesser doctrines. But today, the world-honored one has caused us to ponder carefully, to cast aside our old doctrines and the previous filth of frivolous debate. So in our case, cast aside your old views, who you thought you were, what you thought you was true, because you didn't realize that actually you are the heir to great wishes, great riches, right? So that's the story, the parable of the rich man and his son. So I don't know if that actually has much to do with our case, but it all seemed to hang together when I thought about it. So do you ever feel alone and poor? And it's worth noticing that he does ask for help in whichever reading of the story you think of. He asks for help. The teacher responds. And he shows up for that response. And the teacher reminds him that you've been rich all along, You've already tasted the finest wine. You've already touched the depths of your heart. And yet you forgot, For 50 years you forgot. So the math is a little strange, though. So if he was gone for 50 years, and then 20 years of shoveling the excrement, and his father's presumably 20 or 30 years older than he is, and some more time when he was managing the storehouses, so these were quite old guys by the time the dad made that announcement, So one hopes that we'll notice before we're 90 that we're actually okay. We actually have what we need. We are alone and poor. And that's fine. Because, of course, whatever it is we think we're trying to accomplish, whatever it is we think we need to have in us or have in our possession, eventually we'll be chanting for you as we slide your body into the oven. And you won't need any of that anymore anyway. But you will have tasted the finest wine in China. So it'll be okay. We'll cry, but we'll be happy for you too. Okay. I'll stop.
May our intentions be equally accepted.